The floppy baby story also began in South Australia. It's a story about genes and babies and long-term detective work. Meet Kristen Novak and Professor Nigel Lang from the University of Western Australia.
Our work with this group of diseases, the congenital myopathies, actually started with a large family from South Australia. The real beginning of all this was walking down Alice Springs High Street with Eric Hahn, who's the chief clinical geneticist in South Australia. And he said, Nigel, we have this family in South Australia with 10 living affected people. Are you interested in working with this family? And of course, 10 is the magic number. And that family was big enough to track down. So that's where we started from. And in 1995, we tracked that gene down to being a mutation in tropomyosin, which is one of the proteins of the thin filament in your muscle fibers.
Okay, so it affects muscle in what way?
Children are born affected, and in the most severe form, they can be born almost completely paralyzed. And then there are a spectrum of severity through to adult forms. So an nemaline myopathy can come on any time from in utero to being an adult. And it was always known that it was genetic, and the question was how to track down the genes. And that first big family from South Australia basically unlocked the disease.
How did the family respond to being under your microscope?
The family was very keen to be involved, and it all went very smoothly.
Well, with these genetic clues, Kristen, how did you come to be involved?
I started with Nigel doing some work experience, and he was brave enough to take me on as a research assistant to start with, and I found that he was so dedicated to the families that we were researching, and we were studying DNA samples from patients and families all around the world.
Now, when you say work experience, do you mean when you were at school, you were just wanting to know what it was like in a lab?
No, I actually had already graduated. I'd done my Bachelor of Biotechnology and then Honours. But I do remember thinking about DNA and finding it really exciting at school. So I can remember one of my Year 10 teachers telling us about her family. She had about six or seven siblings, and she had a lethal form of dwarfism in her family. And I remember her then telling us that they could track down what was causing that disease with DNA.
You became a tracker. What did you do?
Nigel had met a professor from Germany, Hans Goebel, who's a leading expert in neuropathology, and he had presented three patients, and they were unrelated, who had this unusual form of pathology in their muscles, and two of them were very severely affected and had died within the first few months of life. And Nigel had looked at that and said, it looks like there's aggregates of actin, which is one of the fundamental proteins of making your muscles contract. It looks like there's a lot of this protein aggregating in this muscle. Perhaps one of the genes that's involved with this disease is actin itself. And over a period of probably 6 or 12 months, DNA samples from these patients were sent to us here in Perth, and we were able to study the DNA. And we found the first mutation in this gene called actin. And that was the first time anyone had found mutation in that gene. And then we ended up finding three different mutations in these three patients. And it started from there.
What we showed was that frequently, because it's a lethal disease, the affected children have new mutations not present in either of their parents. So the mutation has arisen de novo in either the sperm or the egg that give rise to them. And that's a clue that that's what's causing the disease.
Why should it happen like that?
The way I think about that is every time our cells divide, you basically have to type out, I worked it out one time, 17 years of type non-stop typing. And no biological system is that accurate. So every time our cells divide, we get new mutations, and it's just fate.
It's like the difference between the word fist and fish. Fists and fishes are quite different. That's only four letters.
Yeah.
So a mistake like that, at that gigantic scale, you're bound to get some sort of error. Now, the latest paper isolates it down to this particular gene. In what way has the latest paper refined things?
One of the things that we hypothesized was that those are the mutations in the actin of your skeletal muscles. And we always knew that there's also another actin gene, which is for your heart. And that actin is also the fetal actin in our muscles. So it's expressed in our skeletal muscles before we're born. And then for reasons that nobody knows, it's switched off around about the time of birth. And so we thought that one way you might be able to treat the skeletal actin diseases was with cardiac actin. And then we found another group of patients who have no skeletal actin in their muscles. And what we found were a number of patients who have no skeletal actin in their muscles at all. When we first did the analysis of the gene and found those mutations, I thought this couldn't be true, because the clinical picture of some of these patients was not as severe as some of the patients with the dominant actin mutations. And so what's the answer? The answer is those patients with the recessive absence of skeletal actin have themselves kept their fetal isoform, their cardiac actin, going. And so they're existing on having cardiac actin in their skeletal muscles, which isn't normally there.
Have another supply.
Yes. But we found those after we started, Kristen started doing the mouse work. So what we set off to do with the mouse work was to see to what extent cardiac actin could replace skeletal actin in skeletal muscles.
Yes, so we've done that, and we were able to make some transgenic mice that kept their cardiac actin switched on after birth, as well as their skeletal muscle actin. We didn't know whether that itself would be deleterious, because maybe nature had made it cardiac actin be switched off for a reason. And then we also imported some mice from Cincinnati. Professor Jim Lassard made some mice which were like these patients Nigel was telling you about that had no skeletal actin. And these mice die about 9 days after birth. And we think it's the cardiac actin that's there during development that keeps them alive. And then once that switches off and the skeletal actin is supposed to switch on at birth, it's not there to do so. So unfortunately, they die. We're able to breed these mice together. So we created mice that didn't have the skeletal actin, but instead they had the cardiac actin in their skeletal muscle after birth. And we were hoping that they would live a little bit longer than 9 days. And in fact, they did, and they're still alive now after 2 years of age. And that's another time when Nigel didn't believe the results, and he made us repeat it many times. And they were running around just like their litter mate controls, who were normal. But the exciting thing is we found not only are these mice surviving, and they seem to be running around and doing quite well, but they actually do better than normal mice. So we found that they can run about 2.5 times further than mice usually do, which is kilometres per day. And they also are more active. And what's interesting as well, we're not sure if it's because of all their running, but they have less visceral fat. They have less fat around their kidneys and their reproductive organs, about three times less fat. So that's something that was quite unexpected.
It's amazing. But one thing that puzzles me, if this actin, this material, which is essential for the working of your muscle, is there separately in the system for the heart, why doesn't it stay in the heart? How does it get to the skeletal muscles and the biceps and legs and all that sort of thing? Why isn't it just confined to the heart?
So what we've done is we used a skeletal muscle-specific promoter to activate it in the skeletal muscles as well. So it's there in the heart, and it's now in these mice there in the skeletal muscle also.
So because all those cells have got the same sets of genes, you can switch on the heart material.
We've genetically engineered the mice so that they'll express the heart actin in their skeletal muscles.
Right.
So these are genetically modified mice. So these aren't just normal mice where we've managed to activate the heart gene in skeletal muscles. But that's the next step that we would have to go through to try and treat the actual human patients, because you cannot make genetically modified
people.
Right?
Not yet anyway.
No. The ultimate prize with this work is to try and find some way in the patients of keeping their cardiac actin gene going in their skeletal muscles after they normally switch it off, or getting it switched back on again.
If you crack the puzzle, how many potential patients are we talking about around the world?
These are rare diseases. As far as rare diseases are concerned, one of my readers in the University of Edinburgh said something once, which was that if you've got the rarest disease in the world, it's the most important disease to you. And that has stuck with me as someone who works in a group of rare diseases. But these are nasty, nasty diseases. I said the most severe forms of these, which a lot of the patients who have actin mutations have, they're born almost totally paralyzed and they go into ventilators straight away. And couples who've had a child like this do not want to have another child.
Sure.
And so tracking the gene down and making prenatal diagnosis available all around the world has been a huge thing for these families.
Professor Nigel Lang at the University of Western Australia with Dr. Kristen Novak. And a good article on their achievement is in the current edition of Australasian Science magazine. Saving babies with useless body muscles by growing them heart muscle substitutes instead. Clever stuff.